I call this meeting of House Finance to order. Let the record reflect that it's 1:35 p.m. on Tuesday, February 14th, 2023. Happy Valentine's Day. Happy birthday to two of my daughters, Kirsten and Signe, for the record.
Are they twins?
No.
Wow.
It's like Vegas odds right there.
Exactly.
With us today is we have Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Staff, Representative Colomb, Representative Ortiz, Representative Kronk, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Foster, Co-Chair Foster, Co-Chair Edgeman, and myself, Co-Chair Johnson. Thank you to our moderator, Emma Turner, from the LIO, and Finance Secretary Bree Wiley for being with us today. And today we have an overview from the State of Alaska Department of Health. Presenting, we will have Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee and staff. Also online, we will have available for questions. We will have Chief Medical Officer Ann Zink, Acting Director of the Division of Senior Disability Services, Tony Newman, Renee Gayhart, Director of the Division of Healthcare Services, Farina Brown, Acting Director of the Division of Behavioral Health, Heather Rogers, Administrative Operation Manager for the Division of Public Health, Deb Etheridge, Director of the Division of Public Assistance, and I think that's the end of our list. Ms. Hedberg, would you like to come forward and put yourself on the record if you would like to bring anyone else forward, please go ahead and introduce them and ask them to put themselves on the record. Welcome.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee, and with me today I have Assistant Commissioner Josie Stern and Deputy Commissioner Emily Ritchie and online Dr. Ann Zink. So advancing to slide two, on July 1st, the Department of Health and Social Services reorganized into two departments, the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services. This visual on slide two is a helpful reminder for which divisions went to which departments. Department of Health retained the prevention, systems, and payments. Department of Family and Community Services has the direct care services, also commonly referred to as the 24/7 facilities. The department reorganization was good. It provides a smaller span of control and allows the commissioners to focus on divisional work and system operations that support population health and person-centered services. The Department of Health and Department of Family and Community Services continues to coordinate on improving the continuum of care for person-centered care and working together on complex care coordination. Complex care coordination is defined by a person that utilizes more than one division or department program. These individuals have complex needs and require a lot of resources and supports that can be incredibly costly. Both departments are working on a complex care plan, which will help streamline healthcare services with the desired result of better client care and cost savings. In addition, the two departments also continue to share IT resources and are working on a roadmap to separate those IT resources. The May 2021 cyber attack highlighted the technology debt, overburdened, and overtaxed IT systems. The roadmap will support both departments identifying the necessary resources to support the HIPAA-compliant services for Alaskans. Slide three is the Department of Health's mission to promote and protect the health and well-being and self-sufficiency of Alaskans with a focus on systems of care to ensure Alaskans receive timely services. We serve every Alaskan from birth through elders. While not exclusive, but to give context for what the budget supports, a few examples include senior benefits, Medicaid eligibility, background checks, licensing and oversight of health care and child care facilities, Medicaid services such as physical health, dental care, and behavioral health services, vital records like birth, marriage, and death certificates, and personal care attendants for Alaskans that have disabilities and seniors. The department has 10 appropriations that operate as 6 divisions and Medicaid. The list of divisions are on the slide. Slide 4 is just a visual reference. It's a great tool to see which programs are within each division. We also have a handful of boards that are associated with the Department of Health. And with that, I will turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Josie Stern to provide an overview of the operating budget.
Thank you. For the record, Josie Stern, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Health. Looking at this chart, you can see that the Department of Health's total FY 2024 requested budget is around $3.1 billion. This slide does not include departmental support services, human services, community matching grants, and community initiative matching grants. These items are usually presented as a singular item and are not shown here because the majority of the changes that occurred with the bifurcation of the Department of Health and Social Services occurred within departmental support services. If these items are included, the total requested budget is around $3.14 billion. This graph presents 3 budget aspects. Fiscal year 2022, which represents the total actual spending from July 1, 2021 to June 30, 2022. Fiscal year 2023 management plan, which is a true-up of implementing the FY 2023 enacted budget. And the fiscal year 2024 governor, which is the governor's proposed budget that was released on December 15th. Both fiscal year 2023 and 2024 show the budgetary authority of the department. Looking across these total numbers for the Department of Health, there have been increases in unrestricted general fund, also known as UGF, driven by inflation, increased utilization, as well as federal and state rate increases. As a result, the majority of the increases reside in Medicaid services. The department received more federal funding in fiscal year 2022 due to an increased enhanced federal medical assistance percentage, also known as EFMAP, which accounts for the largest difference in federal authority from FY 2022 to 2024. There was also an adjustment in fiscal year 2022 to move a reimbursable services agreement with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management from federal COVID to other COVID. The department received funding from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, also known as FEMA, for COVID-19 activities via this department.
For the record, my name is Emily Ricci. I'm Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. And I'm going to talk about slides 6, 7, and 8. So I'm sure you're all familiar with the Medicaid program to some degree, but to provide some highlights, it's a joint state-federal program that offers health insurance to low-income families, children, and individuals, as well as those with disabilities. The purpose of the Medicaid program is to provide health coverage to Alaskans in need. Medicaid is an entitlement program, meaning those who meet the eligibility criteria are entitled to benefits. These benefits are outlined in state and federal regulation and statute, as well as through a state plan. The state plan acts as the agreement between the state of Alaska and the federal government, outlining which services will be provided to which individuals under what circumstances. I would emphasize that because this is a joint program, making changes to the program is challenging, time-consuming, and frequently requires state statute and regulatory changes, followed by submission of a state plan amendment to the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, also known as CMS. The Medicaid program plays an important role in the lives of many Alaskans, with over 262,000 individuals currently enrolled in the program. This represents over 35% of Alaskans, making this the largest health coverage in the state. As I stated earlier, this program is a joint program financed by both the federal government and the state. At a minimum, the state shares 50% of the cost of eligible services, including administrative services, with the federal government covering the other 50%. In practice, the total cost share between the state and the federal government is higher, averaging between 72 to 73%. This is because the federal match, called the FMAP, which was discussed in the last slide, may be higher for certain types of services. For example, the federal government will fund 90% of administrative costs for Medicaid systems development, 100% of eligible services for, through the Indian Health Service or our tribal health organizations, 90% of costs for Medicaid expansion, and 65% of costs associated with the Children's Health Insurance Program. So between that blend, you tend to see higher overall federal matches than the 50-50. You may notice there are no specific positions associated with the Medicaid component in the budget. The work and the positions to administer the program are embedded in the division's budget lines. Any additional funding the divisions are able to leverage or any cost savings they achieve are reflected in the Medicaid budget rather than their division budgets. This is a large program. As you can see, the total spend in state fiscal year 2022 was $2.5 billion. The state share for that was about $610 million, with the federal share at $1.8 billion. So to put that in context, what this means on an operational basis is that in state fiscal year 2022, 6.3 million claims were processed within the Medicaid program, and that creates a weekly check write of between $45 to $50 million. So every week, the teams in the Department of Healthcare Services and other divisions supporting the Medicaid program are paying out $45 to $50 million and processing annually 6.3 million claims. So it is quite an undertaking. So moving on to slide 7. This slide briefly highlights a combination of cost drivers and cost savings or cost containment measures. I'm going to start with the cost drivers and then walk through some of the cost savings or cost containment. The primary cost driver or cost savings reflects changes in federal regulations that impact the federal match we discussed in the prior slide. Aside from enrollment, this item has the largest cost, the item that has the largest cost impact are changes to the percentage in the federal match. Increases in federal match, like the enhanced 6.2% federal match we have received for the past 3 years, can result in substantial offset of general fund dollars required to fund the program. Alternatively, reductions in the federal match, which we're going to experience with the reduction of the 6.2 enhanced federal match beginning this spring, can result in increased costs to the state. Other cost drivers include inflationary adjustments in the amount that providers are paid. The average Medicaid inflationary rate component in fiscal year 21 and 22 was 1.8%. This inflationary rate is significantly lower than what we've heard providers actually experience. And we all see this in our own experiences at the grocery store or purchasing other items. Rates are also routinely adjusted. They are reviewed and reset on a schedule outlined generally in regulation. The timing for these adjustments varies depending on the service. More frequently, rates are redetermined or rebased for the first year of a four-year cycle, and then inflated annually for the following 3 years. The process then repeats. Another important cost driver is enrollment in the program. In 2020, in response to the pandemic, that states across the nation suspended eligibility reviews, or what we call redeterminations, as part of the federal government's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. We're going to talk about this in more detail in the future slides, specifically slide 9, but the result was an increase in the overall Medicaid enrollment by around 30,000 Alaskans between 2020 and today. The good news is that there's been some very strong and successful efforts to contain costs within the Medicaid program. The most impactful of these is tribal reclaiming. This is a process where the state is able to receive 100% of federal funds for eligible services provided to a tribal member covered by the Medicaid program in certain circumstances. In FY22, the state saved $74 million through the tribal reclaiming program. Since this process started in 2017, the state has saved nearly $380 million. Other important saving mechanisms include recovering eligible drug rebates, which created $123 million in savings in FY22, as well as ensuring Medicaid is a payer of last resort, meaning that if there are other health insurance plans or other coverages that should be paying first, those coverages are paying first. This is also called subrogation. And this means that the program ensures other eligible payers like Medicaid are picking up the bill. In fiscal year 2022, these activities resulted in around $470 million in cost avoidance. However, a portion of that would be experienced by the federal government, not just the state. And other important cost savings measures include program integrity, which focuses on eliminating fraud and abuse, as well as case management programs.
Yeah, I really, thank you, Madam Coach. I really appreciate the presentation, but is there any way to do this without reading verbatim? Because it really detracts from the interactive process of the committee workings. And I understand you've got maybe one or two more slides to go, but it's a long presentation. If we're going to get read this, I might as well just go back to my office and watch this on TV. It'd be nice to have a back and forth and being able to, you know, and I don't, you know, I would say that I appreciate the detail and I appreciate the attention to all the detail, but I can get that later on. What I want is to have a dialogue, if at all possible. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, I have no more comments on the slide, but I'm happy to entertain any questions before we move to the next one.
Well, let me just, is the plan then to go through this whole slide deck, just reading through it? Is that the plan? And I'm not trying to be snarky or offensive or anything, but it's just much easier when I'm talking to somebody who works with this stuff day in and day out, who can kind of tell it to me as opposed to read it to me.
So I was also having a hard time following the detail. Could you encapsulate what you just in your own, you know, just encapsulate that for us so we can have a sense of what we just talked about here on the slides?
Chair Johnson, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. Essentially, there are major cost drivers and major cost savings measures that the state engages in regularly. The major cost drivers are going to be federal match. Whether that increases or decreases, that can be a cost driver or a cost saving. It can be enrollment, the number of individuals in the Medicaid program, and again, that can change. Most recently, we saw a change with the response to the COVID pandemic in 2020, which required that enrollees remain continuously eligible, except for very specific circumstances. That resulted in about 30,000 additional enrollees at this point. And then, in general, we're seeing rates increase, particularly in relation to inflation, inflationary factors, as well as the routine review of rate, what we call rebasing, that the division and the department periodically undertakes. So those are kind of the main cost drivers that we're seeing. On the cost saving side, tribal reclaiming has fundamentally changed, I think, how the state engages with the tribal system and how the Medicaid program benefits from that system. So that's a very important cost savings measure.
So I see a number of questions, but I want to make sure, just to be fair, I believe Representative Hannon had a question, but I don't know if you still had a question.
I do. It's on Medicaid, but it is slightly different tack. And I can't remember if you were at the department when we – so I serve on the corrections subcommittee, and one of the things in the corrections budget that's a huge cost for them is their health and rehabilitative services. And the fact is that when people go into custody, except for 24-hour stays in the hospital, if they were previously Medicaid-served, it's discontinued, and that's an element of Medicaid in our expansion waiver. Representative Ruffridge, who serves on that subcommittee, the underlying committee, who is a pharmacist by trade, and said this wasn't supposed to happen when we had Obamacare expansion. Then we heard a little off the record side that, well, it depended on how your state did state expansion. And I'm just curious, when we did Medicaid expansion, whether we talked about including and negotiated with the feds for coverage of our incarcerated citizens or whether we didn't. Because, of course, without it being Medicaid and without people's private insurance or even tribal health or VA services, it just comes straight out of UGF budgeting for the Department of Corrections, which they've got some cost containment measures going, but it's a pretty unhealthy population, et cetera. And so I'm curious as to whether in the Medicaid expansion dialogue there had been any talk about coverage continuing for our incarcerated citizens.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, for the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. In terms of who was in the department at that time, I can assure you, I'm the one with the longest tenure in our current position, and I think I hit 93 days. So what I would like to do is follow up to get some additional history on that specific question. But I can tell you that the coverage terms we have in place are nuanced, you know, particularly regarding more than 24 hours out of a facility. They follow the national standard. I know that there are other states. There's been a recent development. I believe it was California just received a waiver within the last 3 weeks from the federal government to provide expanded coverage to individuals who are incarcerated. So that is kind of the first of its kind that has been approved in nationally in the U.S. So kind of that's the knowledge I have today, but we'd be happy to follow up with you and get you more information about how that coverage works.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hannon. We have a few other questions. We had Representative Staff, Representative Tomaszewski, and Representative Josephson. So, and I will add Representative Galvin to the list. So next up is Representative Staff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to, well, I guess any one of you wonderful folks can answer the question. So I'm trying to save most of my comments, I think, through the subcommittee process. But on the topic of tribal reclaiming, so I think in FY22, there were 159,000 applications for tribal reclaiming. The department was only able to reclaim 20% of those. So my question is, what can we do to better facilitate more tribal reclaiming in the future?
Through the chair, Representative Staff, we have the expert in the state on tribal reclaiming with us here today, and if possible, I would like to invite Director Renee Gayharda to help answer that question with more detail.
Finished?
Yeah.
All right, very good, Representative Staff. Next off, we have Representative Tomaszewski. Sorry.
For the record, my name, that's really loud. My name is Renee Gayhart, Director of Healthcare Services and Representative Staff through the chair. The tribal reclaiming started in 2016 after the state health official letter allowed states to reclaim the remaining balance on American Indian and Alaska Native beneficiaries. So the referral process that you're referring to, there's a couple of things before that. So in order to enter reclaiming, there has to be, for all American Indian and Alaska Natives throughout the state, whichever tribe is providing their services and they're referred out to a non-tribal setting, there has to be a care coordination agreement in place between those two. So for instance, would be someone from ANMC going to Seattle Children's. They would have to have an agreement between those two entities to enter any kind of reclaiming. The referral validation piece, which you're speaking about, has to actually be validated by the tribal health organization for the state of Alaska. So we lose a lot of referrals just because of the way data exchanges or doesn't exchange. And then in addition to that, the third requirement is that that exchange of data has to go back and forth between the two entities. So another, for instance, if someone went from ANMC to Seattle Children's for a transplant and then came back to Alaska, those records would have to go back and forth. So when all that is said and done, you have to have all three of those elements in place. So it may seem as though 159,000 claim lines is a lot and only 20% is reclaimed, but it's often because those exchange of information systems aren't speaking to each other, the health records and the exchange of those records. So it's actually a very manual process, and we end up looking at actual paper files. So it's administratively burdensome, but that's what, you know, takes it to about 20% referral. We have been working with the Center of Medicare and Medicare Services, CMS, to see if we can come up with a more streamlined approach. But the state of Alaska is actually the most aggressive tribal reclaiming state in the union. So a lot of the other states are following our lead, and we're really pressuring CMS to change the way they look at that state health official letter.
Thank you. All done this time. Thank you, Representative Staff. Next up, now we have Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair to any of you on the topic of Medicaid redeterminations. So I know they're going to be starting here shortly. Are you using the same dilapidated programming that trying to get the redeterminations? Or are you set for that process as it started? Do you feel like you're going to be able to process those redeterminations in a quick, you know, in a fast manner? Or what do you see coming in the future on that subject?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski. This is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. And we will cover this in more detail in slide 9, but at a high level, the systems that we currently have available to maintain Medicaid eligibility are the same system. They're the systems that we have, and they are the systems that we will be utilizing through the redetermination process. There's a lot of work that has been ongoing, and there's a lot of work that will continue for the next few weeks, and quite frankly, the next few months as we undertake this. This is a large challenge, not just for Alaska, but for every other state in the U.S., and there are certain timeframes and guidelines that we have to communicate with CMS or with the federal government regarding our ability and our plan to operationalize the redetermination process. And I can talk more about that in slide 9.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Next up, we have Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I think for Ms. Gayhart, on the subject of tribal reclaiming, I know that that started up in earnest in the previous administration. And my understanding is that we actually hired additional staff to do it. We funded those. Mm-hmm. I'm going to assume, and you've sort of suggested as much, that there's a finite capacity here. It's not, there aren't infinite possibilities to fully reclaim and see savings. That's sort of what I take from your comments. Is that fair?
Representative Josephson, and through the chair, not necessarily. I think what you might be seeing in the numbers is during the pandemic, there was a reduction in service delivery overall and transportation. So those reductions you saw was because the services didn't happen, so there was nothing to reclaim. You're going to see an increase again in these out years after the pandemic because the services have started to increase again. So the other thing I want folks to keep in mind, too, is we're reclaiming on the back end. But if the tribes start providing more services on the front end, you're getting the 100% on the front end. And we don't have to do the additional work on the back end for the reclaiming with the prior periods. And so what that means is the staff that were hired are working on two fronts. They're working on with the tribes to expand as much service on that front end so that the tribes take on more services for their beneficiaries, and then also increasing the reclaiming on the back end. So what you're seeing in reductions right now is because of the pandemic, and also because we're trying to work with CMS and redefine the terms of the state health official letter.
Okay. A follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, I think for Ms. Rishi, as to inflationary adjustments and rate adjustments, when I was first in the subcommittee that looked at this issue and on this full committee, I thought those were things that required legislative action. But the way you described it, it almost sounded like it was some administrative adjustment that probably was merited, but that we just watched happen. Can you clarify that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, for the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. I would say it's a little bit of both, right? We have regulations that articulate and outline at what increments we undertake review or rebasing of certain services. There's also certain rates that are based on national standards, something called RVRVS, which is a terrible acronym, relative resource-based something. And those are updated on a national basis, on a national level, on an annual basis. And so to the degree that some of those updates happen as articulated in regulation or through federal updates, those flow into the program, but ultimately all of those items have to be reflected and approved in the budget through the legislative process. So there is that kind of back and forth. And there have been periods of times where rates for certain provider groups have not been updated or rebased, you know, in a way that reflects the regulatory schedule. I think home and community-based waiver services were an example of that. Those did receive increased funding last year in FY23, but those rates hadn't been rebased prior to that since 2011. So there are certain services that may not be updated regularly. So, like, unfortunately, like anything in Medicaid, it depends.
Thank you.
All right. Oh, Representative Galvin.
Nope. No, it got covered. Thank you.
Okay, very good.
So moving on to the next slide, this is Emily Ricci with the Department of Health. So there are two increments in the budget that are specific to Medicaid that we wanted to cover today. The first is extension of postpartum Medicaid coverage from 60 days to 12 months. This has an anticipated annual cost of $2.6 million. While this coverage has been demonstrated to result in savings in long-term studies, the immediate cost for paying those additional claims is estimated to be around $2.6 million. Then there's an additional increase of $18.1 million in UGF, and that is associated with some of the cost increases we spoke about in the earlier slide. Those include about $7 million in Medicare Part D changes, which impact how much the state has to pay on behalf of those members who are Medicare age eligible and participate in the Medicare Part D program. There's about $3.2 million that are associated with an increased encounter rate. That is a rate that is paid by the department to our tribal partners and our FQHCs, our federally qualified health centers. There's additionally $2.3 million increase associated with that RBRVS acronym I spoke about, which is the method used to determine payments for professional services. And then there's some additional increases associated with the home and community-based waiver services I spoke about, as well as some audit findings. So that's kind of a very, very high-level overview of that increment.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair, increased utilization rates, with the redetermination, shouldn't we probably be seeing a decrease in utilization rates throughout this next fiscal year?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski. This is Emily Ricci with the Department of Health. And, I think there is a lot that is unknown at this point, including the answer to that question. Part of it is that we're not sure at a state or at a federal level how many people will actually be determined to be ineligible as a result of the redetermination process. It's kind of a question I think everyone is asking, and I've heard estimates from 3% to 6%. One of the other items to think about is if those individuals who are no longer eligible for coverage under the Medicaid program are individuals who have been utilizing services or who have not been utilizing services. So I want to say about 75% in general of the enrollees in the Medicaid program actually utilize services, and there's about 25% who don't. So I think the answer to that question really depends on how many individuals are disenrolled and whether those individuals were utilizing services.
You need a follow-up? Yes, so when someone is enrolled in the Medicaid program, do they have to reapply every year, or do they just carried on year after year until at some point there's a redetermination?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, this is Emily Ricci. So typically redeterminations would happen every year, so there would be an annual review in most cases. There are some instances and some categories where that might occur on a longer period of time or a shorter period of time, depending, but generally it's about a year. Beginning in 2020, in response to the pandemic, that review was suspended. And so there were really only three reasons that an individual could be disenrolled. They moved to another state, they are deceased, or they contact the department and ask to be disenrolled.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to slide 9. This slide just provides a high-level overview of what has been referred to as the unwinding of the continuous enrollment of Medicaid, or what's being more frequently referred to as redetermination process. And so, as I said earlier, beginning in March of 2020, states were required to maintain eligibility status for Medicaid beneficiaries, except for the three reasons I just stated. This was in response to the public health emergency. However, beginning in April 1st, Alaska and all other states around the U.S. will begin the process of redetermining Medicaid eligibility for these individuals. And the continuous enrollment requirement was included as part of a lot of, you know, the federal legislation that was passed in response to the pandemic, but it was tied initially to the ending of the federal public health emergency. And what happened is there was a lot of speculation over the past, I want to say like 6 to 12 months, about when the public health emergency would end, how much notice states would be given before that end, and how much time they would have to prepare specifically for this process along with other elements of the end of the public health emergency. There was no clear guidance, but there's a lot of speculation. So at the end of December, Congress passed the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2022, and that effectively separated the continuous eligibility requirements from the public health emergency. And it gave states some definitive time frames for when we could expect to begin the redetermination process, what some of the rules around the redetermination process would be, as well as what the phase down of the temporary enhanced federal funding match, how that would occur. So to put this in perspective, we really didn't have concrete guidance on this until after that passed at the very end of December. So states have been working really hard to think about what this means and to plan for it. You can see here on the right, the phase down of the temporary enhanced FMAP will happen over the next 4 quarters. So it will begin in April is when you will see the first step down from 6.2% to 5%. Beginning July 1 of 2023, the step down is further reduced from 5% to 2.5%. And then from October to the end of the year, it's reduced to 1.5%. And then beginning in January 1 of 2024, that enhanced FMAP is gone. So part of the guidance that came out in January associated with the passage of that federal legislation was that states will have 12 months to complete redeterminations of eligibility for all active Medicaid cases. So we have 12 months to complete, we must start on April 1st, but we have 12 months to complete the redetermination process and 14 months to finalize disenrollments. And that's because there's a period of delay where you know, between when someone is potentially determined to be disenrolled and essentially 60 days for them to work through the process and say, wait, I think we got this wrong, or we say, wait, we still haven't been able to get a hold of you. So the final disenrollments will occur 14 months after the beginning of April. I would say the first disenrollments specifically associated with the redetermination effort will start at the end of May, because we begin that review process in April, and there's generally a 60-day period. CMS, the federal government, is aware that this is a big lift for many states. They have had a number of calls. We have engaged in at least 2 technical calls with them to talk through some of the items that have been brought forward by the committee already, our aging and very challenged enrollment systems. So we have 2 systems. One is called ARIES, one is called EIS. EIS is a legacy system. It's very challenging to use. Most of our Medicaid beneficiaries are enrolled in the ARIES system. So that is good news, and programming is already underway to have auto renewals occur in that system. I think the testing should be finalized by the end of February. So to the degree that we are able to automate renewals, meaning we can utilize resources, information from other databases like the Department of Labor or the Permanent Fund Division to complete information for applicants. The systems are in place to automatically review those and to put them through the system. The big question that we have is, and again, nobody really knows. I've talked to other states about this, and estimates are all over the place. What percentage of our total renewals will occur automatically, and what percentage will need to be manually worked? And that's one of the big questions that we're trying to work through right now.
So we have a couple of questions here. First, we have Co-Chair Edgman, followed by Representative Stapp.
Yes, thank you. And clearly, this is a slide that really bears a little bit of attention in terms of its widespread impact. And I guess to keep my questions, maybe just to a couple. When you go through this re-enrollment process, I mean, you're speculating that there's somewhere 263,000 Alaskans. We don't know what that number ultimately is going to be, but it's just interesting that that for a state with 740-some thousand people, that one out of three people are on Medicaid. I've never done any research. I think I posed the question to maybe Commissioner to you at one point, maybe in our visit a week ago or so. Is this an inordinate amount relative to other states? Maybe not. But Emily, if you want to speak to that in a moment. But the other interesting sort of high-level question outside of the challenging process that sort of awaits you in terms of this re-eligibility process is the fact that Alaska's population continues to taper off, but our Medicaid usage rate, I think, is going up. So maybe two questions in there. Do Alaskans use the Medicaid program higher than on average in other states? And two, really, I think, and you just spoke to it, are we aging as a state and just having more people being eligible for Medicaid than before?
Through the chair, Representative Edgeman, Emily Ricci with the Department of Health. So to the first question, I think I would like to follow up to get you exact estimates, but in general, I would say around 30% or slightly thereof is not unusual for states, just based on my recollection from the different statistics that I've been looking at. So I don't think we're unusual in the proportion of Alaska residents who are eligible and participate in the Medicaid program. In terms of why that number is increasing, I think, part of it reflects, a large portion of Medicaid enrollment is based on income eligibility. So there is an element of that that has changed probably over the last, 8 years, 10 years. I mean, the state has had some changing economic factors. In terms of an aging population, I don't know that that has as much of an impact on the Medicaid program. It certainly does, but on portions of the Medicaid program, particularly our home and community-based waiver system services, but less on kind of the adult general enrollment. I would say that's probably more of that gets more into an issue of kind of rate reimbursement as the population ages and more individuals are eligible for Medicare. Medicare becomes a bigger portion of a provider's book of business than it has prior, and that has economic impacts.
Follow up, Representative Edgeman?
Yeah, just a quick follow up. Thank you for that. Last year we passed a permanent fund dividend that was three times larger than the year before. And I know there's a backfill component to the budget, and I just asked the subcommittee chair on a sidebar here, and it's somewhere that $20 million range that we put in the budget. Can you just speak to what that backfill amount might be rather than me speculating a number?
Through the chair, Representative Edgeman, I believe you're speaking about the maintenance of effort, and
yes,
Josie Stearns, Assistant Commissioner, is prepared to speak to that in more detail.
And through the chair, this, of course, relates to eligibility, income eligibility.
Thank you for the question. For the record, Josie Stern, to the chair, Representative Edgeman, I believe you're talking about the hold harmless. Is that correct? Okay. To the chair, Representative Edgeman, the PFD hold harmless has been steady over the past few years and stays around $17.5 million. Historically, we've only spent about $15 million. The past in FY22 was about $11 million, so it was lower than in previous years.
Okay. Yeah, through the chair, I'm not sure. I'm not an expert on this budget, but I'm not tracking why that number wouldn't rise commensurately with the size of the PFD or the aggregate amount of the PFT relative to all the applicants.
To the chair, Representative Edgeman, the PFD hold harmless is an account for when the PFD goes out. Sometimes it pushes individuals above the income limit, and then they become ineligible for services. So it just depends on what individuals are pushed out of those services. And so this fund covers them. And so in FY22, and also because people were not allowed to be disenrolled, the actuals were lower in FY22 than in previous years.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. We have, next up we have Representative Stapp, followed by Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I'll try to keep it a little brief to our wonderful folks at the Health Department. Regarding the determinations, is it my understanding that are we going to use administrative determinations or ex parte determinations, redeterminations? That would be the first question.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, we will be using ex parte redeterminations to the degree possible. I think about those as kind of those automatic renewals where you're using information from other sources, but we will not be able to utilize those for all redeterminations.
So follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
So through the chair. So typically, or at least my understanding is, you get the income data for ex parte administrative redeterminations generally from SNAP applications, right? I mean, that's the kind of provision in which the federal government allows you to verify income verifications. So given the current state of SNAP, do we have the ability to use the income verification that we already do on SNAP to do the Medicaid redeterminations? Does that make sense?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. So I think that is one means that can be used to inform these ex parte renewals, but there's other means, including information from the Department of Labor as well as the Permanent Fund Division. And I know that we also have Director Deb Etheridge on the line as well, and she may want to expand or add to my comments.
I'm sorry, who would like to?
Deb Etheridge, Director with the Division of Public Assistance.
Ms. Etheridge.
This is Deb Etheridge. For the record, this is Deb Etheridge, Director of the Division of Public Assistance. Deputy Commissioner Ricci is correct that while SNAP approval does expedite a Medicaid approval, we also have the ability through the redetermination process to verify income using Department of Labor data.
Yep. Just one more follow-up, if you don't mind, Madam Chair. I am sorry to, maybe I'll show my own ignorance here, but how would the Department of Labor have individual income data on individual people in our state?
Through the chair, this is Deb Etheridge, Director of Public Assistance. There is a shared database that has income data on individuals that we access through the Department of Labor, and I will would like to follow up to provide you that information directly so I can, if I could follow up after the meeting.
Yep. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Thank you, Representative Stapp. Next, we have Representative Josephson, followed by Representative Hand, and followed by Representative Galvin.
Through the chair, for whomever is best situated to respond. So I look at this 14-month period, or 12, as a blessing in that that's a chunk of time. And I understand there's two things going on. One is the federal government is giving us less FMAP and as we're sort of winding down from COVID. And then there's this redetermination. But my question is, having looked at the SNAP experience, and, you know, this morning I met with food bank people who said their shelves are empty. What is it? It's hard for those of us who don't live in this world to know the problem avoidance we're looking for here. So is it someone who needs surgery in a year and can't get it at federal and state government expense? Is it someone who gets the surgery but then the doctor is unpaid because they were Medicaid ineligible? What is the – we have 12 months, and I guess what I want to do – and this is sort of how I operate, I guess, is I want the agency to tell me everything they could possibly need, every exigency, every contingency, load it up and just tell me what you need so that this is, and I said this to at least one of you, so that we avoid this sort of problem. Is there, first of all, what is, Let's say we didn't do any redetermination. What happens? Let's start with that.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health. If we were to undertake no efforts to redetermine eligibility, that enhanced FMAP in quarters 2, 3, and 4 for calendar year 2023, we would not receive that. That's kind of one of the ultimate penalties, is that in order to receive that step-down enhanced FMAP, there are still certain requirements that we have to undertake. That's partly why we're communicating with CMS in our technical plan. There's also reporting requirements that start April 8th so that they can kind of monitor how many and what proportion of the population not only are reworking through applications, but how many are being disenrolled. And in response to your question about, you know, what happens ultimately if disenrollment or redetermination does not occur, or I think the division is late in making eligibility determinations for any reason, new applications, disenrollment, you know, for any reason, what happens if those determinations don't occur? I think you alluded to part of this, but that individual may not be eligible for health coverage that they would otherwise be entitled to. And so the hospitals may be contacting the division, trying to find out, you know, why aren't they getting reimbursed for the services they offer? Providers might do the same thing. I think really when we see eligibility errors occur, because those occur in the system on a regular basis, to be honest, like they don't occur systemically, but eligibility errors will occur at different points. And one of the first indicators in our system that that's happening is when people go and try and fill medications, right? Because that's almost an immediate, you see that bill immediately, and it's that point of sale denial. So those are some of the impacts when someone is not receiving, they're not properly enrolled in the Medicaid program when they are eligible for that. I would say in terms of what we need right now, we need and we are exploring partnerships.
Say that again.
We need and we are exploring partnerships, right? So to the degree that we can work with other entities or organizations that are providing care to Medicaid enrollees or are providing services and may engage in this process in some other means already, maybe partners that are already collecting this information for other uses, is there a way that we can partner with them to make sure that our technicians and our DPA, our Division of Public Assistance staff, can benefit from the work that they're doing? So when I think about partnership, I think about partnership in a couple of different ways. One is communication. This is going to be a 12 to 14 month effort, right? And actually it's slightly longer because we're starting now. So what needs to be communicated to which groups at what point? I think right now our message is please update your contact information so that when letters do go out to you, they're going to the right place. They're not going to the wrong address. And our Division of Public Assistance has set up a line through the what they call the VCC or kind of their call center specific to updating your contact information. So people can start calling in and have a specific option that is just reserved for updating contact information and provide that to an eligibility technician that's dedicated to take that information and update it. So the first thing people can do between now and April 1 is to make sure that we have the right information. We are also developing a draft communications plan, because what we want to do is share that with our stakeholders and say, what are we missing? What did we get right? What did we get wrong? How can we do better? You know, what other ways can we reach people? So that's another way that we can partner. And then the third way that we're exploring partnering is what I described, and is perhaps the most complex, which is really, again, are there ways that we can leverage what other entities or groups are already doing to collect this information to make sure that we're leveraging that? And I don't know if Commissioner Hedberg has anything she wants to add about other resources.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee, through the chair, Representative Josephson. I think that Deputy Commissioner Emily Ritchie did a really good summary, I think, of three different succinct buckets. One is updating information. We need every individual on Medicaid to call the virtual call line and update their information. Two, when they are called up to be redetermined for Medicaid eligibility, that is when we need to collect information. And so we are currently actively engaged in conversation with our partner organizations and the healthcare industry to say, what can you do to help us collect the verification information? The third component, a merit employee, a state employee, has to make that final decision whether that individual is determined eligible or ineligible. And so that resides with the Department of Health. If somebody is determined ineligible, that's when we want to pivot them to the federally facilitated marketplace so that they can find another appropriate health insurance plan. We don't want any Alaskan to go without health insurance. And so I think of three kind of key buckets, and we are going to leverage our partnerships with the healthcare industry to ensure that we are being innovative and that we are maximizing every relationship so that nobody is lost through this system.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think we have one last question, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson.
Sorry. Before we start, I just want to say that we're on slide 9, and maybe we can get through the last half if we can hold our questions to the end after the, I don't want to say that. I still want people to be able to ask questions, but I think that's important, but I do want to try to make it through our slides in a timely manner.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. What's the maximum time that someone can have Medicaid for without, is it an annual redetermination? Ignoring COVID and this winding down and the special circumstances, but in a normal case.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, this is Emily Ricci, Department of Health. I would say for most individuals, it is 12 months. There may be, again, certain categories of individuals where it is longer. There's a longer time frame.
Quick follow-up. What kind of circumstances could there be longer eligibility for, and how can we move? I have a sister who's passed away in January, but from the time of her disability 14 years ago until the time she died, she was Medicaid eligible. She had an advancing cognitive decline due to MS, and so the redeterminations became harder and harder because she was an independent adult who insisted on doing it herself, yet part of her diagnosis was a cognitive decline, so it became more and more cumbersome. And the only question about medically ever that she wasn't going to be eligible was from screw-ups in the paperwork. There was clear medical evidence she was never going to be holding a job or eligible for other insurance. And I can't imagine that she is really that unique of a circumstance. And so I think of all of our people who are on there who have really complex diagnosis, who are going to annually doing this, but we spend a lot of time trying to keep them eligible, yet there might be a month or two blip. So how do we move those kinds of individuals into a circumstance where they're not taking up all that labor time, both on their end and your end, to make sure their health insurance is intact?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I'd like to follow up with that. I want to talk to our Director of Senior and Disability Services as well, because I think that's the group that would be most likely to have for this to occur, and I would want to have his knowledge.
Okay, thanks.
For the record, Josie Stern, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Health. Looking at this slide, you can see that Medicaid, and as we've discussed, Medicaid is one of the top budget drivers in the state. To draw approximately $1.8 billion in federal funds, the state leverages around $670.6 million. As Deputy Commissioner Ricci spoke about in earlier slides, there have been increases in unrestricted general funds from fiscal year 2022 to 2024 due to those cost drivers that were discussed. The department was also able to collect additional federal funds in fiscal year 2022 due to the enhanced FMAP, as well as the open-ended federal authority.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee. So I am going to speak to the next two slides. We're going to transition off of Medicaid, and we're going to talk about the Division of Public Assistance. So this is a first slide that really just kind of gives a very high-level perspective. Within the Division of Public Assistance, there's 18 different public assistance programs. And the 459 full-time employees On average, for those eligibility technicians, it takes about 2 years to be trained on all of those 18 different public assistance programs, SNAP being one of the more complicated programs. Transitioning to slide 12, so I just want to, this is really, the backlog is in reference to SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. I want to spend just a little bit of time recapping what were the causes and what are the immediate solutions, the mitigations that we're engaged in right now. So in August of 2022, we received an influx of 8,000 applications, and that was sort of the kickstart to this backlog. And really, there's the reason why it started in August was the federal agency, the Food Nutrition Services, also known as FNS, they had a policy that stated that you need to re-verify if somebody is eligible for SNAP every 6 months. That policy decision, the question was whether it was suspended during the pandemic or not, was held in federal court and it was being discussed. Finally, when it came down to Alaska and when we heard that we needed to restart that verification process, that happened in August of 2022. In addition, sort of these underlying factors was that we have a legacy IT system. It's the eligibility information system that has the SNAP program in addition to part of the Medicaid. That EIS system, again, eligibility information system, was built on technology that was based off of 1959. Mainframe, black screen, you can't use a mouse. You're using an F key to jump from screen to screen for verification. That IT system, in addition to all of our IT systems, were impacted by the May 2022 cyber attack that happened to the Department of Health. When the cyber attack happened, May of 2022, we didn't know the depth and breadth of that cyber attack. And we have 181 IT systems in the department. All of them were essentially pulled down, and our IT staff and resources were redirected to the forensics analysis to make sure that we could secure and make sure that we were continuing to protect the health information of Alaskans. It was a significant event, and we are still working through some of our some additional systems that are still not brought back online because of that cyber attack. We still have the same amount of IT resources, and so, again, that cyber attack was pretty impactful. In addition, during the pandemic, there was something called the Pandemic EBT. EBT is an acronym. It's the Electronic Benefit Transfer. It was for children that qualified for a free lunch when school closed down because of, you know, COVID in the school. There would be funds that were transferred to that debit card so the family could purchase food. That was a manual process, think Excel documents. So the manual processes, the legacy IT system, the cyber attack, and then the redetermination that we needed, the new policy that we needed to start verifying SNAP eligibility, that all kind of culminated in August of 2022. And so what we have been doing as a department, I started my position in mid-November and really trying to assess what was going on. I would talk to a lot of Alaskans that were impacted by the backlog. I visited the DPA offices. I talked with staff. I met with the direct providers. I met with the food banks. There was a lot of outreach just to hear what they were seeing, what their solutions were as we were trying to assemble, what were the immediate solutions that we can do right now. And so I want to transition to talk about what are the immediate actions that we're taking right now. First is we have sort of all hands on deck with really focusing in on the recruitment and onboarding of our vacant positions. I think because of the media attention around this, we have seen a significant increase in the number of applications for eligibility technicians, which is great. And so it's, you know, sort of reviewing all those applications. We have a training team. They can train 14 eligibility technicians at a time and sort of going through that process. It's our goal that we, again, are filling our vacant positions. And the team is doing very well in that space. In addition, we asked for long-term non-perms, and we received those positions. I believe it was about 45. And we have been, they were recruited, and now they are being filled, and those individuals are being trained. So there's a big focus there to make sure that we had our staffing and our staff were being trained. The second was we had two vacant positions in our IT department, and we were able to fill them with individuals that actually have experience coding with those antiquated IT languages on the mainframe. So we're very thankful that we are waiting for approval to hire for those two positions, and then they're going to be focusing on the eligibility information system, again, for the reprogramming. In addition, we have two contractors, and we expanded their contract so that our ICT staff have that contractual support, again, for that reprogramming of the EIS system. In addition, we have the virtual call center, and the intended purpose is really around health equity. There's only 11 offices. We want to make sure that every Alaskan that is eligible has access to an office. So we created the virtual call center. You call the 1-800 number. And the intent is when you called, an eligibility technician would pick up the phone, answer your questions, help with that application process, set up a time for interview, and kind of move forward from there. What we've seen because of the backlog is we had a spike in calls. In October of 2022, we peaked at about 2,000 calls a day. Again, Alaskans wanting to know what the status of their applications were, frustration, and or trying to understand where they were. And so what we have done a couple of weeks ago was we engaged in a temporary contract with one of our vendors to have staffing support to answer those calls, answer the basic questions, collect the information, and pass that on to our eligibility technicians. So we have around an estimated 30 eligibility technicians that are on the virtual call center, and we're able to pivot those staff that are trained over to processing the application, again, so we can maximize every state employee's time. The next, again, is around crisis communication, making sure that we're proactive and getting the word out about what caused the issues, what are we doing, and sort of managing expectations. And we continue to work with our public information staff. The other element that I just want to kind of highlight for you, it is unfortunate that just I think due to a lot of the frustrations, there's been some Alaskans that have made some threats. We take every threat very seriously. We want to make sure that our staff feel safe when they come to the office. So we've done two things. One, we're going to have just an analysis of each of our DPA offices to ensure, like, what are the recommendations to make sure that it's shored up for safety. The second is our larger offices in Anchorage, Juneau, Mat-Su, and Fairbanks, that they would have a security guard that could actually engage and de-escalate situations and provide, if somebody collapses due to a medical emergency, that they're able to respond to that medical emergency. A lot of this feedback came from our staff and the public assistance leadership team, in addition to what we've heard from the direct providers and Alaskans. And finally, what you see the last two mitigation efforts. Last year, the legislature provided 20 long-term non-perms to us, and that's the funding for this year for budget year 24. And then this year we're asking for 10 full-time positions to invest in an IT infrastructure.
Yeah, so a question about the and I like that word legacy, by the way, 40-year legacy system. So in the contemplation of separating the departments, there was an executive order in 2021. I can't remember the number. Was it 135 or something like that? But last year's executive order that was successful was executive order 121. But I remember hearing discussion about the IT systems and, you know, the tremendous amount of process work that the old Health and Social Services Department did unto itself, and now the two departments do sort of separately, but in conjunction. Didn't the issue of this old sort of mainframe, whatever it is, system, didn't that arise to the top? Or I mean, why was that not part of a strategic sort of outlook so that we would not have gotten to this place to where we're at now with it?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, that's a great question. So the eligibility information system, 10 years ago, it was slated to migrate off of the mainframe into a new system called ARES. And we currently have ARES. It has Medicaid and a few other programs. That transition from EIS over to ARES stopped 10 years ago. It was only partially migrated over. And what was not migrated over was a portion of Medicaid and the SNAP program. For the last 9 years, it has, you know, there was a physical crisis, and I think it was the funding that was put into the capital budget that was the funding that was slowly matched with federal funds to slowly address the reprogramming and changes to, and we need to get the last portion done to build it to a sense where we can finally move those two programs off of EIS and over to ARES. That is the final goal. And so it has been something that we've been working towards, but we haven't had the funding in order to move and finish that transition off of EIS and into ARES.
Any follow-up, Representative Edgman?
Yes, and I appreciate the response. It I guess makes sense, but it just, on the other hand, it's like, well, why did we not plan for this? I mean, just the basic question, and know that as we all care about and you know, are concerned about the fact that there's a lot of needy families out there that are really suffering the consequence of not having the system modernized in place. And again, not saying it's the fault of anybody, but it just seems like, why couldn't we have planned for this? I mean, if I were to ask just a point blank question, and for the record, you know, the attempts to separate the department into two departments go beyond the Dunleavy administration. I think the Walker administration looked at it. Didn't take this far as, you know, obviously where we're at today. But it just seems to me hard to comprehend. That's all.
We have Representative Stapp, Hannon, Tomaszewski, no? And Josephson, followed by Galvin. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair. So part of the backlog says cost is open enrollment for a federally facilitated marketplace. So I assume when you enroll someone in FFM, their income is too low, you get the pop-up on the CMS website that says, hey, you're eligible for Medicaid, and that CMS hands that off to the state administrators, that application. So knowing that CMS completely knows who that individual is and that they are indeed eligible for Medicaid, what is our potential liability by not enrolling that person in Medicaid in a timely fashion? Does that make sense?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. I think ultimately what can occur is CMS can come in and say that we are not meeting the requirements for completing application and enrollment in a timely manner and can put us on essentially a performance improvement plan or the acronym is CAP, and I apologize because I cannot remember what that C stands for right now. That's one consequence, and then you walk down that road of saying we are going to improve in this way. Ultimately, I think the consequence goes back to what we were talking about earlier, which is the impact to the providers and the patient trying to receive services. In Medicaid, once someone is determined to be, once an application is submitted that is determined to be eligible, so if an application was submitted in January for Medicaid and that was worked in the beginning of February, you can look back 90 days after that January application was received for services that were covered. So there is the ability to receive coverage for some of those services, even if the application is delayed. That is complicated. Retrospective claims reviews are always administratively complicated, and it is not ideal, but there is that period of retrospective review for services that can happen.
Thank you.
All right, next up we have Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. First, a really simple question. Commissioner, you said the cyber attack was May 22. The slide says 21, and I just want to...
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hannah, you're correct, it's 21.
Okay, so that's cyber tech, but the August 22, where you said there were 8,000 applicants, that is correct, okay. Really the crux of my question, and I intend to ask a couple other commissioner designees the same question. This is an explanation of how we're going to fix the problem systemically, but at no point have I heard from the administration how we're getting food to hungry families who many of now have been 4 and 5 months without food supports, where we knew coming out of COVID that food banks were already overstressed. I'm now hearing from small community grocery stores who said, not sure I can stay open, didn't really understand how much of my business through the door was SNAP beneficiaries who are coming in and spending their money, but you know, a month of it, okay, but now I'm 4 or 5 months without 10% of my clientele coming through the door, and I can't keep my doors open. One of the things I think we also heard during COVID was we have government emergency food stores, whether it's with the National Guard or emergency services at DMVA. Has there been any effort through that part to try and get food into hungry families for this 4 and 5 and 6 and 8 months that some families are going to go without food support? And I know that's not something your department would do, but have there been conversations to try and get that part resolved? Not just the systemic problem, but people are hungry today.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hannah. So I just want to clarify, these mitigation efforts are sort of the immediate. I think there's additional long-term strategies, which I had mentioned, just we need to move off of the EIS system and over to ARIES. That's the long-term solution. These are immediate and temporary to kind of get us through this arc of effort. To your question about, and I acknowledge, like, the frustration Alaskans that are delayed their benefits, it is an impact, and I hear heart-wrenching stories. And it's awful. I want to make sure that we can do everything and anything possible to make sure that they have access to those resources. And we have heard from the food banks that it is incredibly difficult, that they are running through very quickly those food. I think the Department of Health's position is we want to be at the table and we want to figure out how we can work with other state agencies and other organizations to resolve this very complex problem of access to nutritious foods. And so, yes, like I've been focusing on the system problems, but there's this recognition and there's this dialogue of how can we work through that. And so that's a conversation that we're actively having right now.
One quick follow-up.
Representative Hannon.
Have we had, since this crisis started in October, any administrative executive branch agencies standing up food delivery programs to feed people now? And again, I know that health doesn't have it, but emergency services, DMVA, the National Guard, and it's not the best food, but it is food, right? I sea rations aren't the greatest food, but they're food. Are we doing any of that to make sure that the out-migration of Alaskans doesn't continue because they can't survive the winter?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hannah, I hear you, and I'm going to take that feedback back to the group so that we can look at every resource. We want to give nutritious food out to Alaskans.
Thank you. I think next up we have Representative Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair. Commissioner Designee, I know that you've spoken about this a lot, and I bet that must be an exhausting element to that. So I'm sympathetic to that. However, the food bank reports to me today two things that could be done that were unknown to me before. One is that 44 states have broad-based category eligibility, which it's sort of complicated, but essentially lets someone earn more money and step down with food stamps. So I look at that and I go, well, the other six states are either really creative and they're the smart ones, or perhaps it's the 44 states. And so I have a question about that. And then the other thing brought to my attention was that we could move to a 12 or 24 month recertification. However, you said, you seem to say, unless I heard it wrong, that the federal government sort of said the opposite. They recently, you were told, or maybe it was last fall, before you assumed the job, that they wanted you to do a six-month determination. And so that's confusing to me. Can you explain? The first question is, why don't we do broad-based categorical eligibility? And the second is, why don't we expand certification times?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Josephson, so there, I'll answer those two questions and say that there was eight different recommendations from the food bank and other direct providers. So to the specific question about the implementing the broad-based categorical eligibility, the prior federal administration had entertained a rule that they were going to get rid of that broad-based categorical eligibility. And so at the time, the Department of Health and Social Services paused on evaluating that rule. That was just brought as an idea to me in December. And so I went back to our Division of Public Health Assistance team, and we are reviewing what that is and what it would look like. So it's under consideration right now. In terms of your second question about a six-month certificate versus recommending the 12-month certificate, so currently, Alaska has a six-month certificate. So when the federal agency, Food Nutrition Services, comes back to us, we have to re-verify every 6 months. We want to move to 12 months. We have to reprogram our EIS system to move to 12 months. That reprogramming of the computer system started January of 2023, and it will take the tentative timeline is January through March for reprogramming. If that reprogram goes well, it'll be tested in an environment to ensure that there's no errors. Staff will be trained, and then we want to roll that out this spring. So that's the timeline. I think it's a great suggestion, and we're working on it. Unfortunately, it is predicated on an old and antiquated IT legacy system that we have to reprogram in order to do them.
A quick follow-up?
Follow-up.
So the interest in the administration in expanding to 12 months, that doesn't need legislative help. That's within the governor's authority to just say we're doing this and making it happen.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, you are correct.
Thank you.
Last question I have here is from Representative Galvin.
Thank you, through the chair. My question was, Representative Hannon's around the emergency. What are we doing now? Have we thought about an emergency order as a state? What? But I think that was covered. So the second question I had was around the hiring. At one point you mentioned that two positions for IT were on hold waiting on permission. Is that because you need legislative funds or is it something else?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, no. When we go through the recruitment process, mm-hmm. Right now the Department of Administration reviews the application and concurs with our findings that individual meets their criteria. So we're just waiting for an approval to hire. It's a simple email. We should be getting it any day, and we'll be able to proceed.
Follow-up. Thank you. In addition to that, those two hires, which sound like they're paramount for us for this work ahead that you have, I wondered if you could share with us a little bit on how it's going with recruitment and vacancy rate of your of other positions that would help rectify the situation.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee, through the chair, Representative Galvin. So as I had mentioned, We had, about a week ago, we had four recruitments for the Division of Public Assistance, different job classes. What we are seeing is a high application rate, which is great news. We're not always seeing that in our other divisions, but we're very thankful we're seeing that in the Division of Public Assistance. And so we have a team right now that's reviewing those applications, and if applicants meet those criteria, then they're going through an interview, and if we get approval to hire, then they go through an onboarding process, and we have a training team that takes cohorts of 14 new employees, and they go through a training for the SNAP application or for the other public assistance programs.
Follow up. Thank you. I appreciate that you have so much energy and willingness of folks to sign on. Clearly, everyone recognizes this is so important to our Alaskan families who have the most need right now. I wondered what number you intend to hire. You said you could train 14 at a time, but what is the vacancy right now? How many holes do you have?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, we would have to get back to you. It's decreasing, which is good news.
Thank you.
All right. So we are on page 13, or we're on page 12, but we're moving to 13.
For the record, Josie Stern, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Health.
Just one moment here. We're at 3 o'clock, and so I'm going to try to. So I wanted to make sure everybody had an opportunity to ask questions. That's a big issue with the with Medicaid and so on, so I didn't want to slow that down, but if we could, we'll save our questions until the end, and so make note if you have questions, and we'll take them then, but let's go ahead and continue the presentation. Thanks so much.
For the record, Josie Stern, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Health. This chart here is the Division of Public Assistance operating budget. It includes a senior benefits payment program, which is usually a separate budgetary line item, but is included because the division operates and manages this budget. The senior benefits payment program totals about $20.8 million in unrestricted general funds.
So for the record, this is Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee, and so Dr. Ann Zink is going to take the last three slides.
Hello, this is Dr. Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer for the State of Alaska. Thank you so much for the opportunity, and I apologize I cannot be there in person due to weather. I will very briefly go through the next few slides, but happy to provide questions either today or later afterwards. So moving on to the Division of Public Health, this really serves as the center point for thinking about how we can help to improve the health and well-being of Alaskans. We've had a robust conversation about the expense of Medicaid and how do we start to minimize those costs. And healthy people are cheaper people, and the work that happens within public health is much of that. This is over 430 employees that brings in over $50 million worth of grant funding into the state. We work extensively to respond to disasters, prevent injuries, ensure quality and accessibility of health care, preventing healthy behaviors, and working broadly across the state. To follow up on a question that Representative Hannah had asked earlier, our program is actively currently working with the BOLTO program, which actually does send out food to affected communities, including those who've been struggling getting food and have been sending them out to one community at this time. Moving on to the next slide, the Healthy Families Initiative. This is an initiative that was set forth by the governor to make this the best state in the country to raise a family. The idea behind it is that strong families are the foundation of a healthy society and a vibrant economy, and it's made up of three major pillars: healthy beginnings, healthcare access, as well as healthy communities. This is a four-year statewide initiative that includes both investments as well as ongoing programming. I would like to highlight the Fresh Start campaign. This is a campaign that we were able to use federal dollars to connect Alaskans to free services to help to manage their chronic health conditions. Any Alaskans can check out the website, but we've been talking a lot about the cost of healthcare, and one of the major drivers for Medicaid is in chronic conditions. And so this helps not only Medicaid beneficiaries, but any Alaskan to help manage chronic conditions and have a healthier lifestyle. There's also a proposed 9.9 UGF in the fiscal year 2024 operating budget for the Healthy Families Initiative. And that's broken down into kind of three major components: postpartum Medicaid extension, which DC Richin mentioned earlier. as well as addressing TB and congenital syphilis mitigation, which I'm happy to go more in depth with. But essentially, it's $2.76 million for tuberculosis, as well as $4 million for congenital syphilis, as we're seeing a rapid rise in these diseases that can cause long-term devastating health consequences, as well as increasing costs to the state as a whole, as well as the Office of Health Savings, which I'll talk about slightly more in the next slide. Moving to the next slide, you can see that the Healthy Families Initiative also has its Office of Savings. And the idea behind this is reducing healthcare costs while also improving the lives of Alaskans. These are the Medicaid beneficiaries as well as others. We've spoken already today about the challenges of providing and changing the way that Medicaid does its work. The initial focus of this would be improving on the Medicaid program as we've got more levers in this area. The first is on subrogation, which DC Rishi talked about earlier. That's, again, kind of making sure that Medicaid is the last payer for if someone has insurance from another type. Pharmacy continues to be a major driver of cost of healthcare, so addressing pharmacy costs as well as improved access to critical medications. We've been able to do this through programs such as the AVAP program for vaccines that work broadly across the state, but looking at pharmaceuticals will be critical, particularly as we come out of the pandemic, looking at expensive medication like Paxlovid or other medications such as epinephrine as well as insulin. And then looking at innovative payment models. While Medicaid's budget is large, while you look at it in one chunk, if you look across the state of Alaska, and this has been brought up previously from Department of Corrections to state retirees and benefits, we actually spend more money with other insurance types, and making sure that we're having innovative payment models that work across payers is critical for a healthy future and healthy economy. So with that, I will hand it back over to the team.
For the record, Josie Stern, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Health. The majority of the increase that you see in unrestricted general funds from fiscal year 2022 to 2024 is due to the Healthy Family Initiative's increments that were previously mentioned by Dr. Zink. There was also a technical adjustment, as mentioned earlier, in FY 2022, and this was to accurately reflect the reimbursable services agreement that the Department of Health had with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs for COVID-19 activities.
Do you expect to see this change with the governor's amended budget and or change with supplemental? And if you would, please send us an updated set of information based on the new information when you get it.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designate, the Chair. Yes, we'll send you an updated slide deck.
Very good. Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I ask one last question?
Certainly. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair for Ms. Ritchie. Slide 10 shows an increase under management plan and then a greater increase in the coming fiscal year for Medicaid. Is that the rebasing and the inflation adjustment?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, that is largely the rebasing and the inflation adjustment that we talked about, that $18.1 million combined with some of the other $2.6 million with postpartum. And I would just defer to Assistant Commissioner Stern in case she wants to add anything to that.
For the record, Josie Stern, through the chair to Representative Josephson, there were two increments in the FY 2023 budget. Those were Medicaid services, and those were also associated with increased utilization and inflation, as well as an item that the legislature added for increased wages for personal care attendants.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for your presentation today. Oh, I see one more question. I think that's going to be our last one. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, through the chair. I did have a quick question for Dr. Zink, if she's still available. I noticed that the governor has put in special attention to TB and congenital syphilis mitigation. I wondered if there has been any recent data regarding chlamydia, which in the past I thought it was also considered a top. Alaska was in the top state, I think number one at one point for cases of chlamydia, and I wondered if there was a reason to not include that or just what the status is with regard to chlamydia mitigation along with syphilis.
Thank you.
Dr. Anzink.
What's that? Did you get the question? Would you like to have it repeated?
Yes. Sorry, they had my line muted. Yes, Representative Galvin, to the chair, for the record, this is Dr. Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer of the State of Alaska. I appreciate your question regarding chlamydia. It was hard to choose the area that we needed to put the most focus on. As you mentioned, gonorrhea as well as chlamydia tend to be very high in our state, and we do have lots of ongoing work and effort. So the reason, in fact, the governor chose congenital syphilis as well as tuberculosis is because of the very rapid rise in these two diseases, as well as the significant impact on both families and communities. So something like congenital syphilis, which can be treated with just one shot of penicillin, can leave a child significantly deformed for life, and the state needs to bear the responsibility of that cost and then just the devastation to that family, as well as tertiary syphilis can cause significant mental health challenges as well as significant health challenges to the adult itself. And then tuberculosis, we have much higher rates in the state for tuberculosis, and we've seen a rapid rise since the pandemic. And the work that needs to be done to really change that S-curve. We're on a rapid rise, and if we intervene now for both of these diseases, I feel like we can make a gigantic difference. That does not mean that the ongoing work for other diseases such as chlamydia and gonorrhea, HIV, which we're currently having a cluster outbreak, don't continue to go, but we looked at what was the most targeted, most focused, most wise dollars that we could spend to have the biggest impact on Alaska's health for the future, and that's why these two programs were chosen.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Zink. Thank you for coming today and presenting to us. Much appreciated. Our next scheduled meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, February 15th at 1:30 p.m. We will receive an overview from the Alaska Retirement Management Board and followed by an overview of the Alaska Public Retirement System and the Teachers Retirement System. Presenting for the ARM Board will be Pam Leary, Treasury Division, Department of Revenue, Bob Williams, Chair, Alaska Retirement Management Board, Elisa Jones, Liaison Officer, Alaska Retirement Management Board. And for the PERS and TERS, it will be Anjay Desai, Director, Division of Retirement and Benefits, Department of Administration, Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer, Department of Administration, Betsy Wood, Chief Health Administrator, Department of Administration. And with no further business before the committee, at 3:12, we are adjourned.